The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
Master Dogen's Genjo Koan, Section 4. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 dharmas. To be enlightened by the 10,000 dharmas is to free one's body and mind and those of others. No trace of enlightenment remains, and this traceless enlightenment continues forever. This is probably one of the most well-repeated verses from this fascicle. To study. We all have experience of studying, school, at least. And it's early usage. To study means to strive towards, to devote oneself to cultivate. But it also has the quality of eagerness, enthusiasm, and diligence. And so to study anything, we have to bring our attention to it and then hold it there, right? So when you're driving down the highway at 60 miles an hour, you can't really study the landscape. You can look at it as it flies by, but you can't study it. Running, even walking, it moves past a little too quickly. We have to stop and look closely. And even then, that's just one moment in the life of that one thing, which is changing all the time. So to really study it, we have to come back to it at another time, another day, another time of day, another season, at another time in our life. It's one of the things I've really appreciated about my life here is living in one place, being able to study and be within this one mountain landscape, to walk back and forth my little commute between here and the Abbassy. Each day, season by season, year by year, and see it change. So Sesshin is very much like that, right? It's a time of stopping. So we quite literally stop a lot of the movements of our life. We close the gate, no phone calls, no work, normal work, no conversation. Sort of bring the movement down to a stillness. And then we look. And then we look more closely, and then more closely still. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To devote ourselves to the Buddha way is to devote ourselves to the study of the true self. It's to devote ourselves to the true self, which is very different than a devotion to our self-clinging, or a devotion to the object of our self-clinging, which is ourselves and our idea of that. And so if to study means to have enthusiasm, to show enthusiasm or spirit, to be eager for the Buddha way, is to have enthusiasm or eagerness to know our self-nature, which, you know, can be difficult. In a way, it can be abstract. In a way, it will be abstract. The teachings point to it. There are lots of ways of speaking of it. But to have enthusiasm or eagerness to realize our self-nature, to a certain degree, is going to be conceptual. Right? We're going to have some idea of what that is and what it might mean to us, how it might transform our lives, based on the reports from those before us. To be eager, to be free of our compassion constricting selfishness. So it's like when somebody asks you, why do you practice? You know, how do you answer that question? The question I like even less is, what has practice done for you? It's like a list. How do we show our enthusiasm? What does enthusiasm mean when it's difficult? Tired, achy, grumpy, caught, tangled. What kind of enthusiasm? You know, these various virtues that Buddhism talks about, they're so important. We all possess them. We all possess all of these different qualities, these different virtues. And in a way, we're practices to bring them forth, to let them really blossom, shine, and to be available to us. When I spoke about the other day about how concentration in the Abhidharma makes the body and mind serviceable. And I think I spoke of that as being serviceable in benefit to each other, but of course also serviceable to ourselves, to our mind, to our meditation, to our ability to meet our thoughts and our emotions in a way that is actually skillful. And so how do we, in cultivating that pliancy, that flexibility, you know, because the samsaric mind is not pliant, right? That's why it's so hard to let go of a thought. It's hard to let go of a grudge. It's hard to forgive. It's hard to be gracious. Sometimes it's hard to be kind, to be grateful, even when we're receiving. But when things are difficult, how then do we have enthusiasm, right? And I think that's part of the importance and power of training together in this way, where, you know, there were mornings where I would wake up and I just kind of didn't want to get out of bed. And I would think of all of you. I mean, that didn't happen this week, but earlier, those of you who would be here in the Zendo, and I would think of everybody who was there or would be there in the Zendo. And so that in a moment where I would have indulged my own desire for myself to stay in bed, thinking of everybody else who was getting up, helped me to get up. Right. So everybody else, the Sangha, helped me to bring forth my enthusiasm, which didn't feel enthusiastic in that moment. If we think of enthusiasm in a particular way, right? High-spirited. And that's why I think it's so important that these terms, these virtues, we think of very expansively, or allow them to become expansive as we experience them in different ways, right? Not just in the way that we would naturally think. So to be enthusiastic, to be eager, to be joyful, to have faith, to persevere, to be generous, to be compassionate. Because of the nature of language, we tend to think of these things, have an immediate sort of gloss on what that is. But if we restrict it to that, then we will miss all the moments where it's actually present. It just looks different. In the beginning, we tend to show enthusiasm for things that, you know, give us pleasure, make us happy, which, you know, is natural. We can understand that. And that's nice, and that's helpful in its own way, but it's not particularly reliable. It's not trustworthy as a guide. And so as we go on to sort of discover or cultivate our enthusiasm, in a sense, however we might feel, for the things that matter most. And in a sense, we could say that that's what Dharma practice is about. It's helping us to bring our attention and bring to the fore those things that matter most, because we have already lived a life where we've put other things, all kinds of things, in front of us, many of which matter, and some matter a great deal, but many things that don't, actually. And so it helps us to really understand what matters most. And that's, so if we think of the emphasis on impermanence, the fleeting nature of things. Right? That in 100 years, none of us are going to be here. None of us. And so to bring forth that sense of urgency, appreciation, gratitude, and to bring into to highlight those things that really matter most. You know, I mean, we hear about it, we read about it, but I have to think that most people at the time of, as they're nearing their death, or they're in a moment where they think their life, where they realize their life is finite, that becomes very real to them. It seems most often that in those moments, they really understand what's important. And at that point, sometimes it's just simply too late. Too late to live in accord with that or to turn themselves towards that. And so if we rely on things that aren't trustworthy, then we're going to be disappointed. I mean, the Buddha said this over and over. It's in a lot of different ways. If we rely on something for some kind of lasting or ongoing or reliable satisfaction or fulfillment, we will be disappointed. He said, basically, don't be surprised, because it's built into that. In other words, it's not of a nature to bring us to any lasting, ongoing fulfillment. The Buddha way and the true self is not like that. It cannot, if we speak of it as something for a moment, it cannot disappoint you. It cannot betray you. It will never forsake you. It will not belittle you, but it also won't puff you up. It won't do anything to you, as a matter of fact. We ourselves can become disappointed. We can feel betrayed. We can forsake and belittle ourselves, or we can puff ourselves up. But that's not the Dharma. That's not the true self. That's like the karmic self having something to do with the karmic self. That's the deluded self making something of the deluded self. But the way, true self, cannot do that, does not have the capacity, it's not of its nature. When we want something different, when we think this present moment shouldn't be happening, this isn't what you planned on for this session, this meditation is not really what you've been working towards, Azuma Roshi said, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. He said, remove to study, then what's left? The Buddha way is the self. What is the self? The Buddha way. Who are you? Who is Buddha? How can we realize Buddha? By forgetting the self. He said, now let's drop away the Buddha way and the self. To study is to study. Discipline is discipline. Enlightenment is enlightenment. Delusion is delusion. Life is life. But we experience a separation, and that causes problems. We don't experience this moment as this moment. Life is life. This emotion is just this emotion. We create separation. There is the internal experience of grasping. There is the external object that we're grasping at. And that basically sets up an inherent conflict. There's something I want from you. You cannot give that to me. I want you to make me feel a certain way, to see myself in a certain way, to provide me with something, and you can't do that. So the grasping mind and the object of that grasping mind are in conflict. That's why that grasping never brings ultimate fulfillment. The self, the Buddha way, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. What self are we talking about? Emptiness is the ground reality of all things. Nothing in the whole wide world and universe exists in a state of independent existence by itself. Autonomous, separate, self-existing, self-being. So whatever we may mean or might refer to when we think of the self, the Buddha way, study the way is to study the self, whatever it might be, whether it's our idea of an enlightened self, whether it's the hard reality of our deluded selves, others' deluded selves, whatever it is, whether it's an object, whether it's a state of mind, an emotion, thought, sensation, name it, everything exists in its own state, has its own nature. That nature is emptiness, and emptiness appears in a multitude of forms. Form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. And it's not separated, it's not two. That's why that sutra and the teachings of the Prajnaparamita are so important. They just say it over and over and over again in 1,000, 10,000 different ways. Because our mind is so inexorably sort of wedded, believing in what our senses seem to convey, which is that everything stands alone, independent. You can move around them, you can move towards, you can move away, you can like it, you can not dislike it, but everything is basically in and of itself, in some absolute sense. And so what self is being studied? Our deluded self, our enlightened self? And so we have to stop to study. Because if we keep moving, that self that we're trying to study seems to keep moving. Right? And so something difficult, we try and move past that. Situation we don't like, we try and move past that. Somebody we don't like, we try and avoid that. So we stop. And we basically hang on, hunker down, and say, I'm not moving, come what may, so that I can see, so that I can bring forth an actual appreciation for the depth and breadth of what we give, assign this tiny little word to, self. And so in that sense of appreciation, we have to, in a very real sense, come to appreciate our deluded self. Not in a, you know, entranced, enchanted, that's what we're trying to let go of. But in the sense of respecting all of its ways, all of our ways, which seem to, for most of us, have started a long time ago. You know, if you think it as children being in whatever our situation was, and our job is to figure out how this world works, and we're relying on those people that are around us, parents, family, friends, and whatever they're doing, whatever they're up to, that is the way the world works, right? And then our job is to sort of learn those lessons, adapt to that world, develop strategies to make it work in that world. So if it's a loving, caring home, if it's a chaotic, violent home, that's the world we were given. And we develop strategies, which are kind of brilliant, really, given what we have to work with. And they get inculcated, they just become what we do, how we are, what we are, and we carry on with that, even after the situation might have changed. And so to appreciate the different aspects of this self arising, right, and how so much of it is to protect, us, our fear, right, our caution, our arrogance. And so to sit down and become naked, just to yourself, just to ourselves, would seem like kind of no big deal. It's a big deal. It would seem like we would just immediately jump into that. We do not. Step by step, inch by inch, sometimes letting go with one hand and claws dug in on the other. And to be able to more and more experience that, see this, practice this, and not be frustrated, angry, self-critical, ashamed, embarrassed. Because none of those are needed. That's just more of the developed habits. Did you see it? I mean, think of all the times Mara comes to the Buddha, comes to practitioners, and goes right to the most vulnerable spot. You know, wouldn't you rather be, who do you think you are doing this? You can't do this. Trying to get into and pull the plug on their confidence, on their faith, on their enthusiasm. And in all of those stories, I've never come across one yet where the nun gets pissed off and starts screaming at Mara. They just wonder, who is this? Who is this saying these things? And then it's like, oh, it's you. I know you. And that's it. Defeated. Now, of course, it's not always quite that easy. But the point is that the anger, the retaliation, the conflict, the hating just further traps us. So we each have a root practice. We go to our seat with this. And it's very important. We go to our seat to do that root practice and not to further an agenda. Right? That's not what it's about. I'm going to work on this. I need to resolve that. I need to work, think through that problem. I mean, those things may very well need to happen. But you don't need to come to Sesshin for that. Just give those time, their own time. Sesshin is to come without an agenda, because who's creating that agenda? The self. So how are we going to study the self by trying not to create it in the moment, if the very way in which we're studying it is a creation vis-a-vis an agenda? So we go in simple, plain. And then whatever appears, clear, murky, love it, hate it, there's something truthful about that, right? There's something truthful, not that it is true, not that it's necessarily helpful. It may be very much coming out of our attachments, our clinging, our false views, but it's truthful because there it is, and you didn't ask for it. So its truthfulness is that it's arising from the self by itself for us to see. It's not necessarily what you want, what you'd plan for, what you'd hope for, what you think should be happening, which is why it's so important. It's not any of those things. From a Buddhist perspective, karmically, the reason it arises right in that moment is because it's ripe for you to see. And if we see it well, if we practice it well, then that's a shifting. That's a turning. Whereas if we don't and we react to it the way we have, then it just gets more calcified. So we face this just as this. We meet that just as that. And think about the significance of that, the importance of that in being able to simply face what is ever in front of us, right? Because even in a well-planned day or session or life, a lot of times shit seems to just happen, right? Right? Not in Buddhism. Buddhism, the universe is not a random place. Everything is dependently arisen. Everything is a result of some sort of cause and effect. But it's not necessarily as we'd planned. And so as we meet all of those unplanned, unexpected things, we're training in being able to meet each of those as they are, to meet reality as reality. So think about it. Right now, some of you are young and lively. Some of you are a little older and lively-ish. Some of you are older still and lively enough. Or you may be any age, and you may have health issues, you may have conditions. Your life might be quite nice. Your life might have some challenges. Your life might have significant difficulties going on right now. We are all getting older. We are all, living within a both resilient and very fragile body that will go through changes in ways we can't predict, and we will die. Reality is reality. Can we face it just as that? To study is to study. Discipline is discipline. Enlightenment is enlightenment. Delusion is delusion. Life is life. To a common sense person, this is like seems kind of silly. What's the point of it? Because it's so close, it's hard. To study the self is to forget the self. You know, I looked up in the Sotoshu translation because this body of scholars, team of scholars, were so meticulous in their translations, and they use the exact same word to translate whatever the kanji that Dogen used was, to forget, which is such an interesting word, right? Just such an ordinary word. To study the self is to forget the self. Well, how is it to forget something, right? You can't make yourself do it. I am now going to forget. Doesn't work that way. It just slips away when we weren't looking. In its early etymology, it can mean to unget. I like that. To forget is to unget it, right? To lose it from the mind. And so we have this language to let it drop away, to relax your grasp of it, to not give rise to a thought, an emotion, a plan, a memory, whatever. In meditation, it's natural to have moments of concentration. I talked about this the other day. And not have self-awareness, the witness. Right? People often ask about that because that's a very sort of primordial aspect of our mind and consciousness that comes forth and that creates a very tangible sense of someone, right? When you're aware of yourself, your thoughts, your sitting, your anything you're doing, you're listening right now. You're listening to my words and you're aware that you're listening, right? So the mind turns back and it's as though there's somebody there that's doing this thing, listening. It's got to be you. And so that self-awareness brings with it a very strong sense that there is a self. And so students often get troubled when it arises because like, oh, there it is again. Oh, there it is again. And I think I talked recently about it, that it's not a problem, it's just an aspect of our mind. And so we can let go of that in constant, I mean, we let go of it in all kinds of moments, but in meditation, there are moments where it drops away completely, and then we're just in a state of concentration, but that's not yet forgetting the self. Students often confuse that, right? In that moment, they're not aware of the self. They may be aware of very little, but it's not yet forgetting. Mazen Roshi said, someone recently asked me, what is discipline? To study the Buddha way is discipline. To know the self is discipline. To realize that the Buddha way is the self is discipline. Become awakened, that's discipline. Really know who you are, that's discipline. That's what's meant by to forget the self. Really be yourself. When you are so, you'll be enlightened by all things. Everything in your life from morning to night becomes the enlightened life. Isn't it simple? I remember years ago when I was spending a summer with my family in North Carolina, I was preparing to audition for schools, music schools, and so I was practicing a lot. And one day I was going down to this little, there's a trailer that was on the property when my parents bought the property. It's really old and funky. My mother called it the carriage house. Oh, you're going down to the carriage house. And so I was going down to the carriage house one day to practice. And she said, you're so disciplined. And I stopped and I looked back and I said, Mom, I want to do this. I want to be doing this. This is what I want to do, right? I want to become more proficient at this. Because she said it in a way that was kind of like, oh, you're so able to do that thing. You keep able to do that thing. And I didn't think of it that way. I didn't experience it that way. There was something that was important to me, and I knew if it was going to be important, I had to follow through on it. And so discipline in Mazumi Roshi's words, I think, means to train. You know, because discipline is one of those words a lot of people just don't like. And for a reason, if you look at a dictionary, so much of its meaning is punitive. Right? But within training, it's not. It has a different meaning. It really means to train, whatever the field might be. And not just in a moment, but in a sustained way. And in a heartfelt way. Right? If somebody's being forced to do something, that's not discipline. They're just being forced to do it. But if they're bringing themselves to it, that's different. And so if we replace discipline with dedication or reverence or commitment or harmonizing inner and outer or selfless love, then to study the Buddha way is dedication. To know the self is reverence. To realize that the Buddha way is the self is commitment. To become awakened, that is to harmonize inner and outer, to really know who we are, that's selfless love. To forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 dharmas, Dogen says. And the Soto Shu translation says, to forget oneself is to be verified by the myriad dharmas. Interesting, to be verified. What? What is verified? The true self. And it's verified by the myriad dharmas. And Mazumi Roshi goes on to, at this point in his commentary, talk about koans. He says, we often practice in Zen tradition by using koans, penetrating questions or situational problems which we can't understand intellectually. Who am I, for example, is an excellent koan. In fact, we practice together precisely in order to directly realize this koan, whether we're working on it or not. Working on a koan like who am I, you have to allow who am I to occupy you completely. To hear sounds with the whole body and mind, to see forms with the whole body and mind, to ask this question with the whole body and mind, is to know it intimately. As long as you, Mazumi Roshi says, and who am I are separate, it's still a relative or dualistic state. Putting yourself completely into it, you'll even forget about being one with who am I. You yourself have been forgotten. Then nothing but who am I exists, and this who am I is in an absolute state. At this point, your true nature will show its face, and you'll have a glimpse of who you are in truth. That's what to forget the self is to be enlightened by all things means. To be enlightened by all dharmas is to realize the nature of a thought, a feeling, a sensation, an impulse, an intention, an idea, anything that we can experience within ourselves. It's also to be enlightened to forms, to perceptions, to the discriminating mind, to awareness itself, to consciousness, to mind, to joy, to sorrow, to happiness, to anger, to blame and regret. That's why it's so important that when we practice, we not have an agenda. We go in open and clear and courageous, just in the sense of being open to anything that might occur. That's all. You don't have to go to your seat looking for, you know, a dragon to slay. Don't. Just go with the sense of whatever is going to arise, it's already there. Right? I mean, think of that. It's already there. So whatever it's doing, it's doing. Whatever it could do when it comes into your awareness, it's not something from the outside. You're not on a drug trip. Right? You're undrugging yourself. And so to just, so that then, without that agenda, and with that open, spacious landscape, all of those various things can arise. The 10,000 dharmas. And we can then turn and study. And that term, study, is what goes through a lifetime of transformation in terms of what that means. In the beginning, it might mean just hold on, stay put, don't turn away. But if we continue, it becomes more and more rich, deep, profound. When the mind is undisturbed in the way, things cease to exist in the old way. They don't have the power to offend. That's how we can come to be okay with not being okay. You're just a person. Can you just be a person? To be enlightened by the 10,000 dharmas is to free the body and mind and those of others. Mazuma Roshi says, free here has interesting implications. First, there's a sense of free and freedom, being unrestricted, unhindered, liberated. But it also has the implication in English of being without conditions or without taking anything back. I give this to you freely, just to give. He says, when you sit in meditation, just sit freely and fully without any expectations or restrictions. Generously, give it. Give the self to the self. Give your awareness to your awareness. Give your courage to your sitting, your confidence to your doubt. The Buddha said, I and all beings attain the way at the same moment. That's what the teachings say he uttered at the moment of his enlightenment. But at that moment, the world was filled with people who were in despair and troubled and in anguish. The same moment, he directly experienced that every body and mind in every suffering human being was at that moment and forever free of any intrinsic suffering. To free one's body and mind and those of others. And so this is really what brings forth great compassion and allows us to meet, be in the presence of suffering without taking it on, without being, in a sense, fooled by that as something that you are, that I am. And so we swim together into hopelessness. Training is to see practice in life as one thing, right? It's like eating. You know, it's like breakfast comes and you think, oh my God, how many meals do I have? I've been eating my whole life. I'm done with that. I'm moving on to other things. We're bathing, right? You don't think, oh, really? I have to do this again? If we think of practice and liberation as a stop along the way, difficult but necessary, so that then we can move on to other things, we don't understand. I remember I was in the Dishku years ago and a student came up to me, true story, with a list. He came up and said, look, I've taken care of these things in my life, work, relationship, check, 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 check. At the bottom, spiritual practice. He said, I need to take care of this now. And I thought, oh, it's going to be tough. All along the way, we just practice letting go of, forgetting, ungetting, unpicking up the traces of practice and liberation. No trace of enlightenment remains, and this traceless enlightenment continues forever. Right? I mean, I remember in my early years, like, that was not a comforting thought to me. I really did kind of want this to have an end, right? And then I could live my enlightened life and go on, and maybe I'd keep sitting, I don't know, I'd work that out. But all of this, really? It's so good that so many of the dreams we have when we're young don't actually come true. And so this is really, Dogen's talking about what is sometimes referred to as losing the shine of enlightenment, so that we can just wake up and enter the day as a person, as a bodhisattva, as a human being, call it whatever you want. Doesn't matter that much. What matters is, what is it that wakes up? Who is that? How does it see the world? How does it see itself? Sufficient, complete, okay, with not okay? There's nothing mediocre about that. Nothing. It is not complacent. It's not settling for anything. I'll end with these words from Dogen that Mazuma Roshi brought forward. There is an easy way to become Buddha. Do not commit evil. Free your mind of attachment to life and death. Be compassionate to all sentient beings. Respect your elders and take care of those younger. The mind of all cravings and aversions, free this mind. This is called Buddha. Don't seek anything else other than this. In order to do these simple things, we do this. To be okay with not being okay. And to let go of thinking that we know what those simple words actually mean. But trusting that you have the complete capacity to meet yourself in any moment just like that. And then that's a door wide open.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.